keep those tweets coming in. Lots of them coming in. Hayden has been tweeting. You can follow Hayden Hewitt on Twitter. It's at Hayden Hewitt. He joins me in the second hour of the programme. What else is there to tell you? There was something else, but we're going to hear from Tony Gosling. Let's hear from Tony. You know who Tony Gosling is? Former BBC presenter. Former BBC journalist. He's a radio presenter at BCFM in Bristol, where he is one half of the team that presents the politics show, which is an excellent programme. He's brilliant, Tony. He has a website called Bilderberg.org, which for me is it's a one-stop shop for everything you need to know about Bilderberg. He did stellar work on the 7th of July bombings 2005 too, throwing real doubt on the official narrative there. He's a really top man, Tony, and I've known him for many years. He's a good friend. But he's travelling in New Zealand. And the last time we spoke, which is before I became ill, back in late January, early February, he was about to head to New Zealand for his trip, for his extended holiday. So he's there, and he's been there since this coronavirus thing blew up. So we'll just jump straight into it, because as soon as I phoned him, we got straight into it. Here's me with Tony Gosling of thisweek.org.uk, the politics show, BCFM. Me and Tony this morning, he's in New Zealand. Tony Gosling, how in the name of God are you? First of all, before you tell us how you are, watching BBC and Sky News today, they're talking about the Foreign Office and British embassies overseas. Are people in touch with you? And when you need to come home, will you be able to come home, T?
Well, I hope not.
Because you're in paradise.
It's locked down in paradise. That's our little joke for it around here. The weather here is absolutely fantastic. It's almost empty, and everyone is being really nice to each other. There's a sort of people waving at each other as they're going past in the car and this sort of thing. Quite a camaraderie. And also on the national media as well. There was one of the announcers the other day I was listening to said, and now we're going over to the latest daily announcement from the fascist dictatorship. So there's quite a healthy scepticism about this amazing lockdown, the unprecedented. I mean, you know, gone in the blink of an eye are all our basic human rights without a murmur.
Right, and we're going to talk about that. The connection is just about holding together, but there is a little problem with it here and there. We'll persevere for the time being. Now, before we talk about that, you believe that whatever this virus is, you may have had it yourself before Christmas. Is that right?
That's right. And I've also spoken to another colleague of mine, a chap called, I'm sure you won't mind me mentioning his name, Glenn Jenkins, who's a campaigner from Luton, one of the former members of the Exodus Collective. He actually went to his doctor because he had such a horrendous flu that wasn't going away. A couple of weeks after the worst bout of it, he said, well, you know, actually, think I need to go to the doctor to see whether there's everything, you know, I've had some sort of serious permanent problem from this. I mean, yes, I spent 3-4 days in bed, Richie, you know, aspirin up to the eyeballs with a book, and felt absolutely dreadful. And I was thinking at the time, this is back at the end of December, thinking at the time, gosh, you know, if I was, you know, an octogenarian, I probably wouldn't get through this. It's a really nasty, nasty, nasty flu. And then for I've never had this before, but 2 weeks after that, a very dry cough, you know, most days, certainly in the evenings, as soon as you kind of sit down and relax, so the cough started. But yeah, I mean, you know, I guess I've got the antibodies, have I? I'm not sure, because it wasn't supposed to exist back in December.
You might do. So is that your gut feeling, that there's a particularly aggressive strain of flu that has landed on us, maybe like we saw back in 2014, 2015, and like we saw back in 2010, I think. Could that be it? Could it be a rotten, nasty, mutated strain of flu? Or is there some credence to the idea that there is a very serious brand new virus out there? What do you think, Tony?
Well, these coronaviruses are not brand new, Richie. They've been around for years. It's only really, I suppose, fairly recently, last few decades, been identified. But yes, it's another mutation of this, or else potentially, of course, it's maybe a bioweapon. It's not impossible that biological warfare laboratories have cooked this up. I mean, I remember right at the beginning of this outbreak, reading a report from New Delhi University saying that they believed that part of the AIDS virus had been implanted into this. Now, that may just have been planted there, put there, but I mean, it seemed like a completely legitimate report from New Delhi University's virology department. They put the statement out saying they haven't peer-reviewed it, but they think the situation is so urgent that people should see it. So it's quite possible that this is some sort of biologically engineered thing, and that would explain why a lot of the press reports are saying that the virus attacks people's immune systems, because of course that's exactly what AIDS would do. But what is incredible is just the way people have kind of all over the world, in many places, not apparently in Sweden, I'm not sure, I haven't heard the latest today, but in some countries are just basically ignoring it. In Russia, I'm not sure how many cases, it's very, very few, the main thing, of course, here is that we've given up our right to travel, assemble, worship, work. In fact, for many people, of course, their businesses could potentially be ruined. Most small and medium-sized businesses may well never be there again. I mean, I was just hearing on the radio here in New Zealand that even the national radio stations and the local radio stations are worried because they may not be getting any advertising revenue at all from these small and medium businesses that keep them going, so they may have to close. Now, this is getting pretty sinister when you start talking about our media shutting down, including one of my favourite shows I listen to regularly, almost every day, was Dan Damon's World Update on the BBC World Service. Now, that's just been unceremoniously closed indefinitely. So we're seeing a big media shutdown. Also, here in New Zealand, all the regional newspapers have been told to close, even though the World Health Organization has made it absolutely clear that you cannot catch this virus from newspaper distribution, that it just simply can't happen. And so, we're seeing all sorts of rights being given up, and almost, it seems, voluntarily, without the police even hardly being involved.
Let me be devil's advocate. I love being devil's advocate with you. I obviously agree with you, but we're in the minority here. I recently moved to Salford. I'm right bang smack in the middle of the type of place I grew up in, a working class community. I'm amongst people that I identify with and that I understand. It's where I came from. And people are saying to me, and they are saying to me, you got it wrong, Richie. I had an aunt of mine on the phone last night to me, a very intelligent woman, my Aunt Margaret, in Waterford in Ireland, listened to the radio show last night. She said, you got it wrong, Richie, you're talking through your backside. People have embraced this. They've not only embraced the need to be isolated and knocked down, but they seemingly are demanding more of it, Tony. They think we're crazy, that we're playing reckless and cavalier, geopolitical commentary on our radio programmes, and that we're putting people in harm's way. Why are all of those people wrong? And the tiny minority, me, you, and a few others, why are we right about the lockdown?
Okay. So, first of all, let's look at the disinformation that's been out there. I mean, we were told, and the thing is, the goalposts seem to have shifted. Well, they have shifted since the lockdown and the new legislation was passed last week. I mean, what we've seen is, for example, the Imperial College's official figures for the projection for the number of deaths going down from the millions to the tens of thousands. That was just altered a couple of days after the lockdown, and this is the main projection that the government decisions were being based on. We've also seen Oxford University coming along with a completely different analysis, saying that there may be no more than normal numbers of deaths due to this, because there's a lot of deaths due to the flu anyway. Of course, it's almost all elderly people that are dying, or people with other pre-existing conditions, diabetes, etc., that are dying. So there is an enormous amount of interrogation. It's a little bit, I would suggest, like the initial stages immediately after 9/11. 9/11 and the 7/7 attacks, where we got fed basically, now this is what happened and that's the end of it, and without any proper inquiry. Now there is, you know, there are some questions coming out now a week later, but various things have changed since we first heard about this. I mean, for example, all the figures that were coming through from Italy beginning of last week, just before the lockdown and around the time of the lockdown, were pretty shocking. But now figures are suggesting that the Italians, many of the Italians, were dying of these pre-existing conditions. And doctors are saying, effectively, that what's happened is a major change in the way illnesses are reported. And that is very simple. I mean, I've seen several doctors around the world, one Swiss one, a German one, another British one, saying what's happening is that the figures of people with this virus are being included when they have no symptoms whatsoever. They just tested positive. Now, they've never known a epidemic of some sort where people who have no symptoms are being tested, and when they get tested positive, go in with the figures. So this is seen to be, in many epidemiological circles, to be completely malpractice. Now, one could, if one was cynical, say that they're trying to massage the figures up to sensationalise them. Sure, the mass media would never do that, Richie, would they?
Yeah, and I've got to give a nod here to the American journalist John Rappaport, because he's done some really good and really credible writing on this in recent weeks. And he's dug down into the actual test for this virus, and he's highlighted, using the World Health Organization's own data and own documentation, that the test is throwing up lots and lots of false positives. And this is a worry. Yeah, I mean, let's talk about the media for a minute. I'm staggered, because I didn't know, and thank God for you being there to be able to report it, I didn't know that regional newspapers in New Zealand have been told to close down. I mean, if that's not an absolutely grotesque attack on press freedom, I don't know what is. We can come back to that in a minute. But what UK media personalities like, you know, Peston and Kay Burley and Adam Bolton and all the rest of them, Kunzberg, of course, on the BBC, they seem to be goading government ministers rather than ask. I mean, it's so awkwardly... It's not awkward. It's so perverse, this. And I mean, you as a former BBC journalist, you as a real journalist, a qualified man yourself, this must make you absolutely sick. They're supposed to be challenging the lockdown, standing on the side of the people, demanding that we're not being hoodwinked. Yet the media personalities I just mentioned, when they've got government politicians on, they're berating them for not making the lockdown even more stringent. It's like year after year, Tony, I think I'll never see the media as bad as it is now. But then something else happens and they seem to outdo themselves. It's shocking, this. I don't know what to tell people about it.
Well, I think you just have to compare it to some of the other cons that the mass media have inflicted on us over the years. You know, appalling coverage of the death of Diana, the inquest of Princess Diana, where it's pretty obvious that, well, I mean, it's obvious to John Morgan and anyone else that bothers to study the police reports, the transcript of the inquest, I'm talking about the French and the British police reports, which John had, and he pulled out all sorts of interesting information for them. That's the death of Diana, an assassination. You know, I don't think there's any doubt in my mind about that. The weapons of mass destruction in Iraq is probably the most famous one, the illegal war that then followed that Catherine Gunn very successfully made into an illegal war by blowing the whistle and The Guardian. And I wonder very much whether anyone who was blowing the whistle from GCHQ would get anything in The Guardian nowadays.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we had the whole 9/11 and 7/7 stuff. Well, anyone that looks into 9/11 will know that the Building 7, which wasn't reported, collapsed supposedly due to a fire. No, it was brought down by a controlled demolition. In fact, Alaska University has just done a report saying that they lied when they said that was brought down by fire. So the 7/7 attacks, which I've looked at very closely myself, we had all sorts. I mean, there was no public inquiry into that. Unbelievable, really. There were just a series of inquests. There should have been a public inquiry, which is where you can get lots of deaths investigated at the same time. They never did that. And we had Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israeli embassy early that morning getting a warning that it was going to take place, although it was supposed to be a surprise attack. None of this was really looked into or investigated properly. We've had intimidation of journalists. We had Terry Lloyd, who was the ITV News journalist, actually just blown up by American soldiers in Iraq. Gabby Rado died in mysterious circumstances. He was a senior correspondent for Channel 4 News. We had Michael Hastings, you know, who was the reporter, he was an author and a journalist, a very, very good US journalist who was reporting on the criminal activities of the US Army in Afghanistan, basically. And then he died in a mysterious car crash in where it looked like his car had been remotely taken over, doing 80 miles an hour down a suburban street with his feet on the foot brake, on the foot brake, as it was filmed by the police car, Gary Webb. The list goes on. So journalism has been under attack, I think, and ever since the kind of 1980s, 1990s, what we've been having is a kind of stenography system where people are just told what to think, and there's no critical thinking and no interrogation of the facts. And therefore, the people who are putting forward these sorts of measures, which take away our civil liberties, are just basically getting a free ride from the mass media. With all their massive billions of pounds and dollars of resources, they're not even asking the questions, let alone failing to get answers for them. They're not even asking them, Richie.
Yeah, when I started off in commercial media, we took, like they would today, we got press releases from governments and from commercial entities and from, not just from governments and commercial enterprises, but we also got press releases from news organisations like Reuters and so on. But there was a practice when I started out, there was a practice to be immediately sceptical and to start and to try and poke holes in that which you were given via press release. But I would imagine, and it's been some years now since I was in a newsroom, I would imagine that the conduct or the code of practice today is when a press release comes down, rewrite it for the spoken word and broadcast it full stop. That's it, basically. Don't poke any holes in it. You know, if it's coming from the World Health Organization, if it's coming from Whitehall, just rewrite it for broadcast lingo and say it, go to an ad break, say it again, go to another ad break, and then leave your program and let the next presenter come in. That's what we have now. And it's horrendous.
I mean, the other thing to mention about this is, you know, this is going to massively affect advertising revenues for the independent, shall we say, commercial sector. You know, I wouldn't cry any tears for Sky and Rupert Murdoch, but you may well find ITV going under because of something like this. And then all you've got, of course, is the state broadcast. I mean, we're talking about the Ministry of Truth is all that would be left. But, you know, there's so much in particularly two things I'd like to point out about the things like the cause of death. I mean, this is obviously being exaggerated. First of all, you know, you've got many underlying illnesses which are actually involved in the cause of death, and yet that death has got to be reported as a coronavirus death. It's not actually a coronavirus death. It's a death which coronavirus has contributed to in a large or small degree. Also, the testing regimes are very, very different in many, many places. It may be that the reason that Russia has got so few results is because they're not testing people. We're not really being told much about that. No. I mean, they're doing quite a lot of testing in the UK, but it's obviously going to have a massive impact on the number of results you get. So you can almost change your number of test results and the number of deaths, of course, because people may be dying. In fact, I'm almost certain that people have died of this without ever being tested for it, maybe back in December, January, even in the UK. I had a very close friend of mine who was in his late 70s who died of a respiratory illness back in January. And, I mean, that was a funeral took place, etc., before any of this came out. You know, everyone was very surprised, thought he was reasonably healthy, and, you know, I mean, just we didn't know why. So the testing regime, and whether you're testing people who are ill, whether you're testing people that are not ill, whether you're testing people that think they might have it but don't, that has a massive impact on what figures you're actually going to get out every day. So these underlying questions are simply not being addressed. They're being left to the government to just change those things without really often saying much about it. And the other thing, Richie, which I found absolutely shocking and incredible a couple of days ago, was in the Telegraph and the Express. I'm not sure if it was anywhere else, but the government had imported a whole load of coronavirus testing kits from the continent, only to find that they were actually themselves contaminated with the live virus.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea that you're going to test somebody that thinks they may have it and then actually give them this virus as part of the test. Now, this is shocking, and it makes you wonder whether or not that was deliberate. It's a very, very difficult thing for any proper pharmaceutical company to contaminate a test with a live virus. This just doesn't, to me, beggars belief.
And these are fair questions to be asking, and they're not being asked. You made a very important point that's worth reiterating there. The categorization of the death as due to coronavirus. That's a very smart observation you made there. I see two different approaches, ironically. I see ITN News, which is still saying such and such a person died after being diagnosed with coronavirus. That's kind of fair. It's a bit ambiguous, but it's kind of fair. Sky and the BBC, right across the programmes, pretty much such and such a person died of coronavirus. You made the distinction there. It's very important. A virus won't kill a healthy person, but it will be very problematic for somebody with an underlying condition. I'm a very fit man, Tony. I've got asthma. I developed asthma as an adult. Every now and then I get a bit of an attack. It's no big deal because I don't smoke. I never have done. And I'm very, very fit. But if I live to be into my mid-70s, late-70s, 80s, if I live that long, well then, as an older man, as a tall man, having had the asthma and the bronchial things, I would be more susceptible to a virus then. So it's a very important distinction that people are not dying of coronavirus. They are people whose immune systems are compromised anyway, and the last thing in the world they needed was a nasty strain, and in it comes. I want to talk about freedoms. There was an amazing woman on Sky News last night, whom I'm ashamed to say I never heard of, but I recorded the audio and it will go out on the radio show. It'll have gone out by the time people hear me and you speak, actually. I'm going to put it on in the monologue. Her name is Fionnuala Ní Éilean. She's obviously an Irish woman from Galway, but she's a lawyer based in America and she's a UN special rapporteur. And she said to Dermot Murnaghan on Sky News last night, and I thought, go girl. I was proud to be Irish tea. She said, I reckon that all of a sudden, she said, we get these recommendations, these lockdown recommendations and these restrictions. And they're 1,000 pages long, she said. It seems to me, she said, that they've been sitting in a drawer for some time on a wish list for governments, including this government, looking for an excuse, basically, to roll this stuff out. And she said it's dangerous. And she talked about the atmosphere in America post 9/11. And of course, on Sky, they couldn't wait to get her off then. You know, get her off. You can imagine them in the gallery. Get her off, thank her and move on. But that was a very interesting point. Would you go along with that? That these restrictions have been on a wish list, locked away in a drawer for some time, waiting for an opportunity like this? Or does that give us a clue that they weren't waiting for an opportunity? We go back to the bioweapon thing, that maybe this illness epidemic has been created, has been landed on us to open up that drawer and to take out these documents to say, right, here you are, new powers. What do you think?
Well, that's a conspiracy theory too far, Richie. I think it's just the fact is that these people are just very quick typists, and they can churn out 3,000 pages of very tightly argued stuff in just a matter of minutes, don't you? Look, I mean, obviously there is a big agenda behind a lot of this, and it's been going for many years. Anyone that wants to check out Catherine Albrecht and her work in the United States has been talking about digital ID, and they're already talking about this ID 2020. Bill Gates wants to have a digital ID where once you've been vaccinated for the coronavirus, you can carry this digital ID around, and then you can go on the bus, you can go in the pub, you can do everything that you used to do. Now, this is very similar, of course, to the social credit system in China, where you have first class or second class citizens. So that looks like what they make. I mean, it's certainly what Bill Gates has said. He's intending to bring in these ID cards over in the United States. So yes, of course, it's part of a much longer and wider agenda. I mean, Bill Gates was saying that a virus could be as bad as a war. He was saying that 2 years ago, I believe it was, at the Munich Security Conference. You know, home of the annual conference held in the home of the Nazi Party, in the birthplace of the Nazi Party. So a cashless society is another thing which has been pushed for a long time. Everybody is saying, we don't want you using cash. That's on the TV here, you know, because it might pass the virus, that sort of thing. Although actually many shops are saying they won't accept cards. They say, I want only cash. That's what I've seen here. And they just wipe the cash, you know, with a cloth or whatever, one of these sanitizer type things. So definitely, I think that this is the sort of thing which is not only manna from heaven for people like Laura Koonsberg, who likes to sensationalize and push specific agendas rather than to ask difficult questions. But I mean, it's also for this enormous lobby for the cashless society and digital IDs, Richie. It's exactly what they wanted. And the other thing, of course, not to forget about is this whole idea of surveillance. This is now becoming normal. The idea that contact tracing, contact following you. So, for example, if you develop the coronavirus, they can then go back through all where you've been, which houses you've been. They're following your mobile phones wherever you've been, and then tracking you back. So now it's just normal to track people everywhere, isn't
Imagine
it?
That.
Because you might need to track them back to find out what they call.
And this came up in this interview between Murnaghan on Sky last night and the Irish woman who works for the UN, the lawyer. She's in Minneapolis. This came up. Murnaghan mooted this idea that we'll all have to carry smartphones in the future so that our location can be identified in times of crisis like this. And again, to the credit of the lady, she was aghast at this idea. Listen, it's amazing. I'm speaking to you now. Obviously, you and I are having a chat. The listeners are hearing a recording of it. It's not live, obviously. As we're speaking to you, it's approaching very, very late in New Zealand, where you're based at the moment. News Talk is a commercial radio station in Ireland, but it's a national one. I think it's owned by a guy called Dennis O'Brien. Not a nice guy at all, but anyway, we could talk about Dennis O'Brien all day long, but we won't. Wait for this. Jack Kwan, who works for News Talk, has published on the News Talk website that in Ireland, the median age of patients who die after being diagnosed with COVID-19 reaches 82, Tony. I mean, Christ, it's right there for people, isn't it? They're announcing in Ireland today that if you die from, you know, having COVID-19 or associated symptoms, you're going to be in your early 80s. I mean, that should send a message out to every Irish man and woman in the country today that should say, right, be careful around your senior citizens, look after them.
Well, okay, yeah, there's a really important note. I mean, when I've been chit-chatting to people within our social distancing here in New Zealand, I always ask them, are they looking after elderly people? Have they got elderly people around
them?
And if they have, I say, well, they should be on high-dose vitamin C every morning and high-dose vitamin C every evening, because what that does is it literally gives your immune system, whether it's healthy or not so good, it gives it always a bit of a head start, or if you catch a virus, any virus, it means that your immune system has the building blocks to build those antibodies to fight it straight away hanging around in your body. So for any elderly people now, it just beggars belief to me that this is not part of the coverage that we're getting, that all elderly people should be on that high dose 500 milligrams vitamin C in the mornings and high dose in the evenings, just to give them a better, much better chance, if they actually catch the thing, to build all those antibodies to kill it off, you know. So that's, you know, why have we not been hearing all that's basic stuff? I'm not a doctor, but most medical people would agree with that, given the chance. You know, that I think is really one of the key signs. The other thing, though, Richie, if I can just bend us around to a new angle on this, is the chief executives. I've seen two or three articles that have turned millions into billions over betting on this lockdown, making loads of money on the casino stock exchange, saying that, oh, I think that the stock exchange is going to go down massively, and they've made a fortune out of that in the casino banking system.
Prior knowledge, Tony.
The other thing is just, I mean, I was just doing some research into this just before I spoke to you, and it's a company called Saudi Aramco, one of the most valuable companies on the planet. It was a share flotation in November last year by the Saudi royal family for one of the highest ever, for $2 trillion they got for it. All of a sudden, the oil market's collapsed. Oh, isn't that a shame? So the Saudis got rid of their 40, 50, 60, 70-year-long, all the money that they made from all the oil over that time. They just cashed it all in just a couple of months before all this happened. Now, I have to raise the question, did they have some sort of insider knowledge on what happened? The other angle for me, and this might be, I'm sure some of your listeners won't agree with me, we had Brexit, didn't we, at the end of January, which all seems to have been forgotten about now. But, I mean, this was the biggest problem and nuclear bomb in the plans of the global elite, you might call the New World Order, certainly the Anglo-Zionist Empire and the Bilderbergs, the people that are basically the political wing of NATO and political stroke commercial wing of NATO that make the decisions that fund the political parties, etc. That is exactly what I'm saying here, is that they had, I think, some sort of reaction to Brexit, because Brexit's spoiling their plans. For the last 50, 60, 70 years, they've been building up this basically totally undemocratic super state, which Britain has said, we're going to show the example and we're going to leave it. And there are many other countries around Europe who are looking at Britain to see how we get on. And I think this is simply their response to say, well, if you're going to spoil our nice plan to have a United States of Europe, then see what you make of this.
Yeah, I can't rule that out. I can't rule anything out, Tony. I can't rule anything out. Tony Gosling is with me. Tony's going to sit with me just for another few minutes. It's getting late there, and he's already done an interview, and he might do more. Just in the last couple of minutes then that we have, Tony, I want to draw your attention to something else that's making the headlines in the UK media today. And it is a video and some photographs of a businessman in Merseyside, or on Merseyside, who runs a very small shop that sells vaping products. And some footage has emerged of him being thrown to the ground and jumped on by a bunch of police officers last Thursday and then arrested because he refused to close the doors of his shop. If that isn't fascism, Tony, I don't know what is. And why am I bringing that up? Because again, the if you look at the comments on social media and under the articles online, the lion's share of the comments are with those who think, brilliant, the guy was putting people at risk, close his shop down and knock him up. The comments that are in the tiny minority.
Okay. Question number one, Richie, has got to be, was he allowing one person in the shop at a time, or was he allowing whole crowds of people to come into the shop? I mean, this is the thing, isn't it? I mean, you know, I'm not against the social distancing rules. I want to, you know, stop the spread of this. I think there's a very strong argument for that, although you might find Andrew Wakefield, the so-called discredited anti-vaxxer doctor, who has proved, really, that the multiple vaccines can be much more damaging to children than having no vaccine at all and getting herd immunity from their parents and or catching the disease at an age where it's safe, which is what was happening before a lot of these measles vaccines, etc. He's done a brilliant presentation on the herd immunity and vaccination and the failure of vaccination to actually that's made measles worse. So, you know, that is a whole nother angle to this, which I think we should be looking at. But, you know, this I think is a good idea to space out from people, you know, 2 meters away. You can have a conversation with someone. You can have a conversation with five or six people. I rather find it entertaining. Around here, we have, you know, sometimes five or six groups of people who are all 2 meters away from each other having a conversation by the side of the road on the grass or whatever, you know, and they're smiling, they're chatting in a way maybe that they didn't do. And it's also this whole thing of sort of waving at people in the street as you go by, you know, because there's not many people around. Everyone is this a kind of camaraderie it's brought out. I'm absolutely not against that, but I think we do need to have a debate about whether vaccination is the be all and end all. The other thing, of course, is that this whole process of stopping this spreading is going to mean that this coronavirus is virulent still for much longer than it would otherwise be. You know, it's going to spread it out. Maybe, I mean, these viruses tend to work their course out in 2 or 3 months. They go round all over the world, sometimes just within one continent or whatever, but they work their way out within a few months. This one, it looks like it may go on and on and on because of the way it's the way it's being dealt with. TruStream Media is another thing I must plug, because they've done a brilliant thing about 12 Monkeys, which looks into the plans. The MIT are saying that they are, what they're going to do is they'll wait for a month or so in the lockdown, they'll release the restrictions in the lockdown, and then all of a sudden the disease will pick up again, and then there'll be another lockdown. So we'll have a series of them. Month of lockdown, a week of no lockdown, another month of lockdown. So that's what they're suggesting at MIT. And of course, this is exactly analogous to Naomi Klein and her whole
shock doctrine idea.
The idea is they shock you and shock you until you take the vaccine, you get your digital ID card, and then you're out and you can go into the pub again.
It's funny you say that about MIT, because Labour's Shadow Health Secretary, Jonathan Ashworth, told Talk Radio yesterday, amazingly, word for word, he said, what we're going to see, I think, he said, in the very near future, is pockets of lockdowns. Wow. And then he said to Mike Graham on Talk Radio, he said, followed by the vaccine when it's ready. And then he said, everybody should have the vaccine. Final question, T. We'll wrap it up then. And thanks so much, mate, for coming on and staying up late to do it. I love you. You know that. And I'm delighted that you're safe and well and we were able to talk today. Final question for you. Do you believe then, and this is only speculation, of course, that when a vaccine is ready for this particular strain of whatever it is, that we will be told it's compulsory? Now, what I mean by that is they won't be able to say, oh, Richie Allen, you have to take it, full stop, or we'll arrest you. I don't mean that. But compulsory in a way that they will say, Richie, you've got to take it, or no more concerts for you, son, no more going to the supermarket for you. What do you think?
Well, I can tell you how they do it. They basically coerce you to do it. So they take away your basic rights, things like right to travel. Let me explain what they did here in New Zealand. I've been chatting to quite a few people, some of them involved in the medical profession, here about it all. And they were very annoyed a couple of years ago. They started to have mandatory vaccinations of the flu for people working in hospitals.
Yeah.
A lot of them were very much against it. They said, oh, well, you know, I just basically, if I catch the flu, I'm going to stay away from work. And once I'm over it, I can go back to work. And these are medical people, they know, you know, this, they're not going to be putting the patients at risk, and they know that, well, that that's a safe thing to do. But no, the medical authorities wouldn't allow that. They said, well, if you haven't had the vaccination, you have to wear a mask permanently unless you're actually on your rest period in the restroom. Any point in the hospital, all day long, you've got to be wearing a mask. And you know what happened? Bit by bit, they all gave in. Until none of them are wearing a mask. They've all had the vaccine. So this is how they do it. They'll coerce people. They'll, you know, make your life very difficult until you do it. And I think that's basically the way it's going to run. But I mean, you know, we've been, it's all sounding a little bit sort of grim, but there are a lot of positive things. I think that this is a fear agenda. You know, isn't that what's going on here? You know, basically a power grab, but they're using fear to get more power by taking away our rights. I mean, that seems to be, to me, the main sort of object of this, but they can't break the human spirit. They're trying. They'll try. It's impossible. We've proved it in history time and time and time again. When I say they, what I mean specifically is, you know, kind of secret government behind the scenes, the people who own the world, the banksters and the Bilderbergers and the you know, these people who have massive equity funds, they own much of what goes on in the world, and they do have a proactive agenda. They always want to have the initiative, so we are on the back foot reacting to it all the time. The P2 scandal in Italy in the 1980s and 1990s exposed Italy was being run by a secret Masonic lodge, P2, behind the scenes. They were basically the bankers, the media owners, and this is not a conspiracy theory. It's absolutely 100% proven fact. That many of the top politicians were part of it. The military were part of it. The senior police from around the country were sitting around that table running the country, and the democratic government were told what to do. And in fact, they assassinated a former prime minister of this group, P2. So that's, I think, what we're dealing with effectively. And they may think that they're very, very smart, that they can tell everyone what to do, but I don't think it's going to be, well, I know it's not going to be possible to break the human spirit. I think you and I know that, Richie.
That's a brilliant way to end it, T. Thanks for coming on, mate. 30 seconds before we wrap this up. When will you be back? And just to go back to where we came in, is the government in touch with you through the Foreign Office or the Embassy in New Zealand. Are they concerned about whether or not you want to get home? I know you travel to New Zealand, you've travelled around the world, but is somebody reaching out to say, how are you and is there anything we can do for you?
Well, we're only two of 10,000 Brits who are stranded here.
Right.
So, yes, I mean, you know, we've been in touch with it's the High Commission here, because, of course, we are, you know, still run by the Queen, part of the Queen's territory. And there's a whole load of stuff going on with the Maoris in Northland where they've set up roadblocks, but that's a whole other story. I simply don't know, but I'm not in any mad rush to get back. It's so lovely here. You know, it's a beautiful place. Lovely people, and you know, there doesn't seem to be any particular shortages here. You can get what you need, and you can have loads of lovely chats with people instead of having to necessarily get a lot of them. You know, used to going to work every day, as I am doing quite a lot of work on this. I've got less free time than I would really like on a holiday. But the other thing is, of course, we've lost our show in Bristol, which is a pity, and we're just at the moment getting the technicals set up because the BCFM has gone on to an emergency schedule, but we're just in the middle of getting the technicals sorted out, Richie, to be able to do that live. Probably won't be at the same time every week, but to get back on live for the politics show remotely. I mean, it's all possible to do, and it's just a question of arranging a slot with the station manager, and we should be back hopefully very soon. I'll keep you posted on that.
Yeah, do, mate, because our audience, my listeners love you and they love the program on BCFM, so
Last week we did it remotely, but we had to pre-record it. We're just hoping, you know, this is a program, you'll find it at thisweek.org.uk. We did a remote program, Martin and I, with an interview with Dr. David Halpin about what his thoughts are on the coronavirus lockdown. And he is, of course, one of the doctors that was very outspoken about the non-suicide of Dr. David Kelly.
Yeah.
And then we took a look at RAF Fairford, which is a US Air Force base in Gloucestershire, and very increased activities with their B-2 stealth bombers appearing there and U-2 spy planes buzzing around. The plane spotter tell us, and of course we got some analysis about what could be going on with all these extra American jets and bombers and Air Force arriving at Fairford Air Base just up the road from Bristol in Gloucestershire.
Nobody in the country doing that, discussing that, not on any commercial station like your program on BCFM, thisweek.org.uk, and I'm flapping here because I'm trying to think of what I wanted to say. Yes, what I wanted to say is
I can tell you one quick thing about that is that the local newspaper just did it as a, oh, isn't it wonderful? You know, look at these wonderful American airplanes that are arriving, and they had big pictures of them. Oh, we are blessed with the presence of these wonderful nuclear B-2 stealth bombers great pictures of them, and, you know, no linking this at all with the potential war. You know, that this could be, of course, this whole lockdown thing could be a kind of drill and exercise. I think Pompeo did talk about it as a live exercise of putting the population onto a wartime footing, back to rationing and all that sort of thing. So we could be looking at that. And it all depends, really, doesn't it, on how long this lockdown really lasts, because the goalposts seem to be shifting the whole time.
On a day-by-day basis. Stay safe in New Zealand and come back on whenever you want. And keep us posted about the politics show. The point I was going to make is that one of the things that's marvellous about your show is how interactive it is. And I love that about it. Thanks, T. Look after yourself.
Okay. Yeah, one of the things Martin says is we're deconstructing the New World Order's agenda in real time. And we do try and do that. It's very important that people do it because it is possible to do. It's just that people who are overpaid in the mainstream press have got no interest in doing that. All they're interested in doing is seeing their own face on the television and increasing their salary. And I suppose they're just basically sycophants.
The Richie Allen Show is live and interactive. All episodes are archived on Podomatic, Spotify, iTunes, and YouTube. For more details, go to richieallen.co.uk.
Yes, you were listening to Tony Gosling there, recorded by me this morning. He's in New Zealand. We're back live in the room. It's coming up for 6 minutes past six on Thursday evening, the 2nd of April 2020. We're back live in the room. My name is Richie Allen. Hayden Hewitt will be live. There's that word they love in the mainstream media again. He'll be live with me in 5 minutes' time. A very important story. Astonishing, really. Don't miss him, the co-founder of LiveLeak.com and the man behind TriggerWarning.tv. Hayden Hewitt joins me in a moment.